Hi, I'm Victoria Stanhope. I'm on the faculty at NYU, and I'm going to talk about the relationship between housing and medication in supportive housing programs. And this is part of a larger body of research that's been initiated by Deborah Padgett in New York City, of which myself, Mimi Choi Brown, Emmy Kidrington, who is here, and Deborah Padgett and Ben Henwood, who's a busy guy. He's also been very involved in this research. So here, nothing dodgy going on. Okay, and so this is the study team. It's the New York Recovery Study. So this is one of the largest qualitative studies funded by NIMH, and it's really been looking at recovery trajectories among people who are now in supportive housing, both housing first and traditional housing approaches. I'm going to focus mainly on the traditional housing approach and specifically case managers, because that's sort of my interest that I bring to this research, is specifically case management. So I think we are seeing a real recognition, and definitely public health has been promoting this. I think finally we're getting this in social work, is that housing is a key social determinant of health. And I think zeroing in on the chronic homeless, which a little bit we've heard about in the presentations, which is the specific group that was identified by Dennis Culhane from the University of Pennsylvania. These are people long-term street dwelling who actually make up a small part of the homeless population but generate a lot of costs. So the thought that long-term street dwelling were not creating costs, actually, when you calculate crisis service, hospitalization, incarceration, this became an increasing sort of focus for policymakers. So we've seen a real target of interventions for this population of chronic homelessness who have severe mental illnesses. So we know, thanks to the landmark study of Colton and Mandershide, that people with severe mental illnesses die 25 years earlier than the general population. So that sort of startling statistic made us really think about services that people with severe mental illnesses were getting and how they were focused on health or not focused on health. So I think we can definitely see part of that mortality also being driven by the fact that a significant part of this population has experienced homelessness at some time. So that housing instability is also having negative effects on their health. So I think now with the Affordable Care Act, we're seeing even more emphasis on social determinants of health. It's trying to push and widen us out of this very medical model, which is not working for the majority of people. And we're now seeing supportive housing, which has traditionally, yes, the housing part of it has been funded by HUD, and then the services part of it has been funded by Medicaid. And what we're seeing with this transformation of behavioral health is that there's more and more potential for healthcare dollars to be going into housing. So we can broaden from HUD to Medicaid dollars, and we can do that through waivers. So New York State now has applied for an $86 million waiver to use Medicaid money directly for housing. So they want to put capital investment into bricks and mortar, not just pay for the services. And they're specifically saying, because housing is healthcare, and also that it will particularly address these high utilizers, yes, of emergency services, which drive up costs, which a lot of people who are experiencing chronic homelessness. And we're also seeing health homes. So health homes are a new mechanism to medical homes, as Ben was talking about, new mechanism to coordinate care. And supportive housing agencies can now be part of these health home networks and maybe even be the central sort of organizing site for a health home. So we're really seeing an enormous potential expansion of healthcare dollars being invested into housing. So currently 250,000 supportive housing units in the US, 34,000 in New York State, but I think we're going to see a big expansion. So so what I was interested in is looking is, so if we're really, really starting to fund supportive housing more with Medicaid dollars, what is healthcare delivery looking like in these supportive housing environments? So why is housing important for your health? So there's the primary prevention, you know, for all of us, the protective factors that we get from physical and mental disorders, chronic illness, and infectious diseases if we're in good quality housing. But if you're in a shelter, if you're in overcrowded substandard housing, or you're actually on the streets, you're going to be far more vulnerable to these things. And then there is more the secondary and tertiary prevention, which makes it just much easier for you to interact with the healthcare system and think about your health and prioritize your health if you have housing. And actually, some of these findings are based on a study that I collaborated with Ben. Ben was the PI, which and it was a participatory research where we worked with a group of formerly homeless, and we really asked them what it meant to their health when they moved into housing through this Housing First program. And they talked very compellingly about what it was like being on the streets and how they knew they had all these health problems. And in fact, we knew, because when they came to Housing First, I mean, the array of physical health conditions among this population was alarming. So they knew they had all these things, all these nagging things, these aches and pains, but really, the top priority was like, how am I going to get a meal? How am I going to stay warm? How am I going to stay safe? So very difficult to prioritize your health when you're dealing with really very immediate concerns about protecting yourself. So once you have housing, you can start thinking about it. You also, obviously, you can engage with the system, though many of them reported a lot of difficulty engaging with the system, even though they now had an address, yes. Still being perceived as homeless and still suffering discrimination from healthcare providers, but certainly a much, much better platform to access health. And also this, that many of them talked about, even if they had gone to a healthcare provider when they've been on the streets and they had been prescribed medication, that medication would be stolen, that it was very difficult to keep track of it when you're moving around. So just having a place, yes, to organize your medication was significant. And then to actually have the luxury to be able to think about what should I eat, have control over what I eat because I can actually cook it myself, yes. And then really think about exercise and working on these things so you have more time and energy to do that. So we know that in all these ways, yes, housing really contributes to your health. So I just want to back up a little bit and talk about supportive housing. Supportive housing is in its simplest way, it's housing plus services. But it's not simple in terms of all the myriad of ways that is structured through supportive housing services. So, I mean, you see many, many different configurations. I'm focusing on what I'm terming to be the traditional approach, which is sort of based on this idea of housing readiness, that even if providers aren't consciously telling you this, this is what you have to go through in order to get to independent housing, is that you have to show you're ready to be housed. So, you know, you're homeless, you come into the shelter, and then if you do well, so doing well is basically that you will engage with treatment, that you will remain sober, and that you will show that you've acquired independent living skills. So there is this sort of graduation that you go through. And, of course, we know that many people fail at one step or another, and that's why, you know, we see about 55% stability within traditional housing approaches. And that's why, you know, Housing First has been such an important contribution, because it's got to the lot of the problems. But this is still the predominant model. So when we talk about funding supportive housing and expanding that funding, still most of those dollars at this stage will be going into these traditional approaches. So, and that's why I think it's the importance of still looking at these programs. So what are the services? So it's case management is the predominant service mechanism that people will have. Most often, probably in traditional, it's you work with an individual case manager. Sometimes it's teams. It may be a sort of community treatment teams, which is what Ben talked about. And so they're really focused. These case managers are really, really focused on getting people through this continuum or graduating people through. Because there's time limits, and so they really have a sort of, you know, there is lots of tension with being a supportive housing case manager, because you're a little bit like a gatekeeper, you're a little bit like an enforcer, but you also want to do the case management, being an advocate, being a supporter as well. They balance many things with not much training. So the funding, Medicaid for the services, and in New York State, regulated by the Office of Mental Health. So it's really driven. So you have to be reimbursed for the services that you're providing, yes, every agency. So that is driven by your service plan. So you work with your case manager, you come up with a service plan, you review it every 6 months, and then case managers go out, and then they write progress notes, which then trigger the reimbursement for their services. So that is a big shaping, because funding always shapes services. That is probably the biggest influence in terms of how these services are being delivered. So this was our smaller part of the New York Recovery Study. So we were using qualitative methods, looking at this relationship between housing, mental illness, and medication. And we had 24 case managers who were recruited from one agency, and they were 2/3 of our entire sample. So we had fewer case managers from Housing First, though that was part of the study. But I'm just focusing on the traditional supportive housing agency that we sampled for. And the case managers would be enrolled in this study if their client said, yes, you could interview my case manager. And then the case manager said, yes, I'm happy to be interviewed. So that was sort of the recruitment process. It's confusing as to why we have that many interviews, but not surprisingly, these case managers came and went with amazing rapidity. Yes, so we'd get one for one baseline interview, and then we'd have another. So the numbers are complicated. But basically, if they stayed in all the way through, then we got baseline 6 and 12 months. But often we didn't. It was sort of chopping and changing, depending when the case managers came in. But this is based on 55 in-depth interviews. So this is the methods that we used. So we had 4 coders. We sort of went very deep with the first 20 transcripts, and then really came up with a pretty good code book, and then reviewed the 35 transcripts. After that, revising the theme somewhat, but they pretty much held, and I think, you know, we felt happy that with that amount of interviews, that we had saturation. So this was our sample. So pretty average for a case manager. As you can see, majority at the bachelor's level, not the graduate level, which is pretty true for most case managers working in supportive housing. You may have one sort of, you know, most likely to be social work. It may be in a supervisory or the team leader, but still looking at a mainly bachelor level trained workforce. And this sort of reflects that some of them were staying around 42% for 1 to 3 years, but it's still a lot of turnover. And then we had the transitional and the permanent. So what did we find? So specifically trying to sort of look at this role of medication, the case managers really, they really saw this program as treatment, yes, and they talked about this frequently, and the importance of that resonating with the people that they were working with, that they had to have acknowledgement. You were in a treatment program, and the people acknowledged that. and that if they really, really couldn't acknowledge that, if they actually articulated, which some did, I'm here for the housing, then that was considered to be a problem, that they hadn't sort of understood what the purpose was, and the thought that maybe, yes, there's some other program would be better for them, because it's not going to work if they don't see this as treatment. So, and then for the, you know, and I think this finding, to be honest, was a surprise to us, how much these case managers talked about medication. Like, I did not expect them to be talking about medication as much as they did. And so yes, you're in a treatment program, then yes, so then you're on medication. So they tie treatment very, very closely to taking medication. And again, then this sort of shows the sort of reasoning that they wanted to see reflected in the service users. And so, not surprisingly, they talked about insight a lot, yes? So insight is really important, because then you acknowledge you have a mental illness, and then you'll take your meds, and then things will be good. So, but to be honest, yes, these case managers had experienced people going off their meds and experienced sometimes the negative impacts of that. So some of this was born out of experience of watching people experience episodes. But for the most part, it was just a sort of automatic sort of association, treatment and medication. And so not surprisingly, because they felt this, they then perceived a lot of their purpose in terms of their jobs was to be doing monitoring of meds and whether people were taking their meds. And even though, you know, they talked about, well, you can't be there all the time to see if people take them. Some of them tried at least once a day to see if they had taken them, or some of them had people take them in front of them. But often they would. I mean, it was interesting. They would talk about this. Well, yeah, so-and-so wanted to talk about, you know, something that was on their mind, maybe a relationship issue or a housing issue. And I'd be like, okay, and then let's get to the point. Have you taken your meds, sort of thing? So, again, driven by the service plan, yes, because medication management was a goal on this service plan, and the case managers felt very pressured to be responding to that and saying, yes, we're working on medication management. And then external constraints of the system that they had, people who were on what we call in New York assisted outpatient treatment, which is outpatient commitment, yes. So New York actually enforces and uses that mechanism. So that was it. So that's when the case manager becomes a gatekeeper, an enforcer, because they have to keep track whether you're actually doing it. And part of that is you're taking your meds. So, and then in the housing interview, so people to do that step up, they would have to go to a housing interview, which is centralized in New York City. And so often part of that housing interview was to show that you had insight and you were taking your meds, and that was success. And the case managers knew that, so they were dealing with external constraints. But I think the data really also told us that their understanding of mental illness was very much like, you know, you've got these symptoms and you have to take your meds. That was their beliefs, as well as dealing with these pressures. So sometimes it could get somewhat, persuasion is a nice way of putting this. I mean, that sometimes, and I think, you know, seeing this is why we see people exiting, why we see your population saying they don't want anything to do with this, because it gets to be at times coercive, and that's all right. So conclusions. So I think very much we saw this equation for many of the case managers, and that was reflected in what they were saying. And so this, when we think about all that's going on in integrated health, you know, we are not seeing, well, very medical model. These case managers on the whole seem to really subscribe to the medical model of, you know, of symptoms and medication. So we're seeing, you know, with mental health recovery and integrated health, a sort of a pushback against the medical model that we give people person-centered care, that they have more decision support. So these case managers were not really entering into discussions like, if you're not taking your meds, why aren't you taking your meds? An acceptance of side effects, all these things. So all that I think we're trying to work on more in integrated health settings, we certainly were not seeing that among these case managers. I think Housing First, definitely, because you don't have that compliance issue and you try and separate the housing from the services, definitely it's an important step forward. But still, we don't see many Housing First case managers who are being trained in decision support and ways to talk about medication. So it's still, and also many Housing First programs still have the problem that they still have to bill Medicaid. So they're still tied to that diagnostic, yes, criteria. So I think, you know, Housing First has, it's a challenge to keep the values of Housing First when you're looking at Medicaid billing. So what can I suggest? I think either if we're going to make supportive, you know, supportive housing this, and we're going to do what sounds wonderful to say that this is a recognition of social determinant of care, and we're going to promote housing as health, that we really train case managers as healthcare providers, which means that they have, you know, far more expertise in dealing with these incredible difficult issues, but time pressed, and the sort of fairly simple equation of how they saw it. Is not giving people that kind of care. Or, God forbid that we do this, but we actually sever the tie between housing and diagnosis, which, you know, in Europe they do, that we just have housing, people get housing, and then they get their health care, and we don't. So I guess that sort of speaks to the medicalization of housing. So that's it. Thanks.